You will recall that on Saturday, brethren and sisters, we saw how the temple guard and the Roman soldiers arrested Jesus in Gethsemane and took him to Annas first. This man who had dominated the Jewish affairs for something like 30 years behind the scenes in Israel. Now, as far as we can tell, this initial interview, which is described in John chapter 18, took place before Annas. We can't be absolutely certain, but most writers are agreed that this is probably the case in the light of verse 13. They led him away to Annas first. The 19th verse appears to present a problem because it refers to the high priest questioning Jesus. But this does not necessarily mean Caiaphas, because the gospel writers refer to both Annas and Caiaphas as high priests. You remember, for example, that passage at the beginning of Luke chapter 3, which speaks of Annas and Caiaphas being the high priests. It seems that the Jews still regarded Annas as being high priest long after he had been deposed by the Romans, even though Caiaphas officially held the title that particular year, as we discussed on Saturday. It doesn't very much matter which of them conducted the interview, but we'll assume for the moment that it was Annas. It's interesting to notice the details of this cross-examination. The whole thing appears to have been illegal right from the start. According to ancient Jewish law, the private interrogation of any accused man, pending a summoning or gathering of the whole council, was forbidden. But this did not deter a man of the caliber and character of Annas. Verse 19. The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. Obviously, he was hoping that Jesus would incriminate himself by the things that he said, or that somehow they'd be able to trap him into making damaging admissions, and so have something to bring against him at his trial. What was he asked about his disciples, do you think? Well, they would probably want to get some idea of the strength of this Galilean movement. Almost certainly they'd be interested to know whether any of the leading men of the nation were secret sympathizers, men like Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea, who had not yet avowed their discipleship. That could be very useful information in the hands of the high priest. And he was questioned about his doctrine, what he meant by claiming to be Messiah, what was his attitude towards the hated Roman overlords, certainly a key question with Jewish rulers at that time in history. And since Annas and Caiaphas were Sadducees, they would almost certainly want further details of his doctrine of the resurrection. But Jesus knew exactly what lay behind the questions. And so he answers rather bluntly in verse 20. I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in secret have I said nothing. Indeed, that had been the principle on which he had taught throughout his ministry. But quite possibly, brethren and sisters, there's also an implied rebuke of the man who was interrogating him. In secret have I said nothing. Quite unlike the tactics which you are now adopting, Annas. Verse 21, why askest thou me? Ask them which heard me what I have said unto them. Behold, they know what I said. And here we have another reminder that this cross-examination of Jesus was altogether illegal. Annas should have been gathering evidence from witnesses who could testify against Jesus from their personal experience and not from the accused himself. You will know the place in the law which says, in the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every point be established. And certainly Annas and Caiaphas of all people would have known that. And when he had thus spoken, verse 22, one of the officers which stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, answerest thou the high priest so? Why this great blow across the face, brethren and sisters? We can't be certain, but let your minds go back to the time, some 6 months earlier, When the chief priests and Pharisees had sent officers to arrest Jesus as he was preaching in the temple court. And instead of doing so, you remember that they came back, they returned empty-handed, and they said, "Never man spake like this man." And I think we can reasonably infer that the officer in charge on that occasion would have been disciplined for his inefficiency in some way. Perhaps he had his pay reduced. Perhaps he was demoted. But the incident would have been remembered in the barracks. And his successor meant to show that he was a man of a different caliber. He didn't intend to suffer demotion or lose his job on account of Jesus of Nazareth. And so he deals him a great blow across the face for his very pointed reply. Now that may be the background to the incident. It's just a suggestion. It says in the Authorized Version that the officer struck Jesus with the palm of his hand. If you look in your margin, you'll see it gives an alternative, that he struck him with a rod, which is obviously a very different thing. Now, which reading do you think is correct? Well, I think the margin is to be preferred here for two reasons. Firstly, because the word smite, which Jesus uses in verse 23 when he says, "Why smitest thou me?" is a very strong word in the Greek. It literally means to flog, implying something very much more than a mere slap across the face. But there's a second piece of evidence, because we have a messianic prophecy in the Old Testament which would appear to settle the matter. "They shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek." And that's Micah chapter 5, verse 1, if you care to make a note of it. Possibly it's already in your margins. "They shall smite the judge of Israel with a rod upon the cheek." Well, it's fairly evident that Annas wasn't making much progress with his interrogation of Jesus, and so the prisoner was sent on to Caiaphas. I think the Authorized Version is a little misleading in verse 24, where it says, "Now Annas had sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest." The Revised Version says, "Annas therefore sent him bound to Caiaphas," because he was getting nowhere with the interrogation. And that would seem to be the correct reading, and it gives us additional grounds for supposing that this initial interview took place before Annas and not Caiaphas. So Annas questioned him, made no progress, sent him on to Caiaphas. We're not told whether there was another private interrogation by Caiaphas or exactly what happened at this point. But we can perhaps infer that as Jesus was being led from Annas to Caiaphas, that he either crossed the courtyard of the high priest's palace, or perhaps he was led along a balcony. And that would have been the time when we read in Luke, you remember, that the Lord turned and looked upon Peter as he was busy denying his master with oaths and with curses around that fire that had been lit in the courtyard. Looked right through him, gave him such a look on that occasion. Matthew gives a different order of events, and so it's very difficult to be dogmatic. If you read the Matthew record, which we'll not do it just at this moment, it implies that perhaps Jesus looked upon Peter as he was being led from Caiaphas to the Sanhedrin. However, the Lord looked right into Peter, and he went out and wept bitterly. Will you turn to Matthew chapter 26 for the next series of events in this unfolding drama? Take up the narrative again in verse 59 of Matthew chapter 26. We find the scribes and elders assembled in the high priest's palace in the middle of the night. And here again was another illegality, for the Jewish authorities had laid down that the trial of a prisoner, particularly where a capital sentence was sought, must in no wise take place during the hours of darkness. And yet here was Jesus being tried for his very life in the middle of the night. But right from the outset, it is evident that things were not going smoothly at all. Verse 59. The chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. You'll notice it says they sought false witness, but found none. Yea, though many false witnesses came, yet found they none. True witnesses to the charge of blasphemy they hoped to pin on Jesus were simply not available. But brethren and sisters, isn't it a strange thing that even though these men were perpetrating one illegality after another and perverting the course of justice, they were intent on preserving certain of its outward forms, going through the semblance of a trial and hearing evidence? And we're like that, aren't we, from time to time? We're like that. It's a very sad commentary on human nature that we can be very high principled people in regard to some things, certain departments of our lives, and yet be utterly blind to our perversity in other directions. And yet we have a very good illustration of this in these men. But I think these verses also raise another very interesting question. Why is it, do you think, that these chief priests and elders were so inefficient in their prosecution of Jesus' trial? They had at least 6 to 8 hours' notice that the trial would take place, possibly longer than that, depending on the precise time of the trial. It was probably after midnight, well after. One would think that this would have given them ample time to get 2 or 3 witnesses together at least, and to school them carefully, to rehearse the story that they were going to tell, and by a little bribery and careful coaching, I would suggest they could have got them almost word perfect in the evidence they would present. It's not very difficult, it's still done to this day. And they would have been able to press their accusations against this troublesome Nazarene without any difficulty. But what happened? These so-called witnesses, all telling contradictory stories, it became quite obvious to even the meanest intellect that there was no real case against Jesus. So something had gone badly wrong with their little plan. I wonder what it was. Well, several interesting possibilities present themselves here. Perhaps there was present in the Sanhedrin some awkward party. There's an awkward squad in just about every gathering of men, as you will know. Some awkward party who kept putting a spoke in the wheel at every turn. Someone who kept saying, that point's only been established by one witness, we need 2 for that. A man of the caliber of Nicodemus, who had previously drawn attention to their perverted thinking. When he said, doth our Lord judge a man before it hear him and know what he doeth? I think we can be confident of one thing, that this meeting of the council convened in the middle of the night was not a full meeting of the 70 members that made up the Sanhedrin, together with the high priest, the 71st. So a full meeting was 71. But I understand that 1/3 or 23 members of the council was reckoned as a quorum. And so we can be sure that it would have been a hand-picked quorum. Dependable men who could be relied upon to side with Annas and Caiaphas. And yet it may be that nevertheless there was someone present who was a secret sympathizer of Jesus, or who was sufficiently unbiased to be able to judge more dispassionately, and whose interjections showed the utter hollowness and the utter futility of the contradictory stories and the feeble accusations which were being levelled against Jesus. But we still haven't explained how it was that the case against Jesus was so ill prepared. There must be an explanation for it, if only we can find it. And if we investigate the details concerning Judas' betrayal of his master, I think we shall find a possible answer to our difficulty. Will you come back to the 14th verse of Matthew 26? Where we read the following details. Same chapter, Matthew 26, verse 14. Then one of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said unto them, what will ye give me, and I will deliver him unto you? And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. And the Authorized Version implies that what they did was promise to give him 30 pieces of silver when he had done the job. But a literal reading of the Greek text of that verse is that they paid to him 30 pieces of silver. So if you have a revised version in front of you, I think that's to be preferred here. They weighed unto him 30 pieces of silver. They actually gave him the money there and then. And when we realize that this accords with the Septuagint version of that prophecy in Zechariah 11, the familiar passage about weighing for my price 30 pieces of silver, we can see that it means they paid Judas 30 pieces of silver on the spot. But when we go to the parallel record in Mark chapter 14, we have an additional detail given. Mark chapter 14, and here the word promised is introduced. Mark chapter 14 and the 10th verse. Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, went to the chief priests to betray Jesus unto them. And when they heard it, they were glad and promised to give him money. And he sought how he might conveniently betray him. So they promised to give him money at some future time, not specified, and the amount is not disclosed. And the Greek word in that verse means promised and not weighed unto him. So you have to put those two records together. And I think that we can infer that what actually happened was precisely the sort of thing you would expect. Just imagine for a moment, put yourselves in the place of Annas and Caiaphas. How would you handle a man like Judas? I think you'd say, right, Judas, this is what we want done, and we're going to give you a down payment now, and the bulk of the money will be paid to you when the agreement has been fulfilled. Because that 30 pieces of silver that they paid Judas was only a trivial sum, brethren and sisters, to these men who handled the millions that accrued to the temple revenue each year. It was just a trivial sum. And I suspect it was just a token payment to Judas to seal the bargain. And had he gone through with a full agreement, he would have collected a great deal more. We know he was that kind of a man. He would have driven a bargain which was to his personal advantage. But what exactly was the full agreement between the chief priests and Judas? And it's been suggested that it was far more than merely showing them how they could conveniently arrest Jesus, and that the real substance of the agreement was that Judas should also be chief witness for the prosecution. What could be better than having one of Jesus' own disciples testify against him? That would make it much easier to press home and secure a conviction on a charge of blasphemy, wouldn't it? Now, if that reconstruction is correct, we have a very satisfying explanation for the chaotic inadequacy of the case against the accused on that dark betrayal night. For some reason or other, Judas must have reneged on the agreement, let them down at the last moment. Perhaps it was the remarkable happenings in the garden at the time of the arrest. You remember the soldiers being thrown to the ground by the power of God, the healing of Malchus's ear, the extraordinary testimony that this was Messiah. Perhaps that had brought a change of heart in this disciple. Whatever it was, he turned round at the last moment and refused to cooperate with the chief priests any further. And so there they were, faced with a very difficult problem. How were they going to get Jesus convicted without their key witness? So now the case against him was not ready. And yet somehow they had to finalize this matter before the night was over and have Caiaphas and have Pilate rubber stamp their decision. Back to Matthew chapter 26 and the 60th verse. At the end of the verse, after struggling with many false witnesses who were quite hopeless, at the end of the verse we read, at last came two false witnesses. Mark in his version says that these witnesses arose, at last arose two false witnesses. And the diaglot says, at last there stood up two false witnesses. implying that they were actually members of the Sanhedrin itself, getting absolutely desperate at the way things were going, and so they abandoned their office as members of the jury, and they became witnesses for the prosecution instead. And these two men stood up and said, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and to build it in 3 days.'" Now, why should they make an accusation like that? Of course, Jesus had said something similar, as we all know, at the beginning of his ministry, when he cleansed the temple. And he had been challenged about his authority. And that was his answer, or almost. Not quite what he said. He didn't say, "I will destroy this temple." He said to them, "You destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up again." So there's a little twisting of his words, a subtle perversion of what he'd actually said, but the general idea is there. But now consider carefully, brethren and sisters, how could this saying possibly be a suitable charge to bring against Jesus? If I were to stand up this afternoon at a meeting of the London City Council and say, "Destroy St. Paul's Cathedral and in 3 days I will build it again," would you consider that some criminal charge ought to be brought against me? I think it unlikely. You might well say to yourselves, "This man ought to see a psychiatrist," or, "This man needs medical help and he needs it urgently." But I don't think you would consider it particularly criminal to get up and make what sounds like a wildly exaggerated claim. So what was behind the accusation? Well, far more, I suspect, than we normally read into these words. Because these chief priests and counselors were men of discernment. They knew that Jesus claimed to be Messiah. And you can be sure, you can be quite sure, that everything he said in public was retailed to them and examined minutely in the light of their understanding of Scripture. So then, when Jesus used these words, "Destroy this temple and in 3 days I will raise it up," he was claiming to be both the temple builder and the true sanctuary of God in their midst, for he spake of the temple of his body. And Herod's temple was just an empty shell. And at first his enemies misunderstood his claim, as John chapter 2 indicates. They didn't understand what he was saying to them. But since then, they'd had plenty of time to think the saying over, and now I believe they realized the implication of his words, that these were messianic claims, and their conclusion had resulted in this accusation. In other words, they were seeking to get Jesus on a charge of blasphemy for claiming to be the temple builder of prophecy and the very sanctuary of God in their midst, far more important than the magnificent building only a short distance from where they were sitting. Now, what we shall read further on seems to substantiate that suggestion. So just keep it in mind. They knew the significance of his claim. I think it's worthwhile to notice at this point that Mark's record gives a slightly more detailed version of the accusation, with some very important phrases added. Mark chapter 14, verse 57 and 58 for context. You'll see immediately that the context is identical. Verse 57, "And there arose certain and bare false witness against him, saying," verse 58, "We heard him say, 'I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands.'" And I think, brethren and sisters, that we can safely assume that Jesus did in fact use those additional phrases, "made with hands" and "made without hands," even though they are not recorded in John chapter 2. Because I find it very hard to believe that false witnesses could have invented phrases of that kind if they hadn't heard Jesus say them. It's very, very unlikely that they would have dreamed up phrases of that kind. I think it far more likely that Jesus did actually use those phrases. So what did they mean? these Jewish elders knew very well what they meant, brethren. Just as we Christadelphians know what is meant in Daniel chapter 2 when we read of a stone cut out of the mountain without hands. We know what it means, don't we? They knew, as we know, that the phrase means not by human agency but by the power of God, of divine origin. And so that little detail recorded by Mark gives added weight to the suggestion that not only was Jesus claiming to be the temple builder and the true sanctuary of God in their midst, but that the elders now realized it and were trying to nail him on that specific charge of blasphemy. But even so, it seems, verse 59, that their witness did not agree together. And at that point, in terms of Deuteronomy, the case should have been abandoned and the false witnesses themselves should have been put to death. Back to Matthew chapter 26, verse 62. And then the high priest arose and said to Jesus, "Answerest thou nothing what these witness against thee?" And that seems to be the sense of the verse, brethren and sisters, omitting the words in italics. "Answerest thou nothing what these witness against you?" Why should Caiaphas speak in such a frantic fashion unless he thought that at last they'd got a charge against Jesus that might stick? Trying to provoke the prisoner into arguing against the charge in the hope that he would condemn himself out of his own mouth. But Jesus didn't say a word. He held his peace. So then the high priest said, "I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." And as far as I can tell, brethren and sisters, just about every single commentator on that verse reads it in this way. They give us a picture of the high priest getting quite desperate at the way things were going and then suddenly having a flash of inspiration. Here's the solution. I'll put the prisoner on oath and force him to incriminate himself. I think there's something very weak about that interpretation. For two reasons. Firstly, why didn't Caiaphas think of it earlier? He was an astute man. He could have saved himself an awful lot of trouble. How come he'd only just thought of it? And secondly, if he had only just hit upon that particular idea, then we must assume that the accusation about destroying the temple and building it again had been set on one side and the course of the interrogation was moving in a different direction. But I want to suggest to you that that is not the case, and that the words of Caiaphas flow on quite logically from the accusation of the preceding verses. If we can see the whole incident as being directly related to the claims of the Lord Jesus Christ, I believe we are more likely to be on the right track. Can you perhaps think of a passage in the Old Testament which brings together all these ideas, all the ideas implicit in this accusation? Destroying a temple, building another, a temple made without hands by the power of God, the builder being Messiah himself. I expect many of you can think of such a passage. But for those who would like a little help, let me make a suggestion. Did you notice what Caiaphas actually said? He said, "Tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God." And those words are so familiar to us as readers of the New Testament, we're apt to forget the special association they would have had in the mind of Caiaphas the high priest. Because he didn't have a New Testament to assist him. A lot of us can be very wise with the wisdom of hindsight. Caiaphas was not in that position. What did Caiaphas mean when he talked about the Messiah, the Son of God? Well, let's have another look at one of those familiar proof texts which we read so often. The promises to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. 2 Samuel chapter 7, just to remind ourselves of the basic structure of that familiar prophecy. We needn't read all the verses, you will know them before we turn to the place. But you will recall that David wanted to build God a house, didn't he? And what happened? Nathan came to him and, in effect, demolished David's temple before it was even built. He said, "You want to build God a temple, David? The only one who can build a worthwhile dwelling is God himself." And God says in verse 10 through the prophet, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel and plant them, that they may dwell in a place of their own and move no more." And at the end of verse 11 he says, "And also the Lord telleth thee that he will make thee an house. And when thy days are fulfilled, and thou shalt sleep with thy fathers, I will set up thy seed after thee, which shall proceed out of thy bowels, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build an house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son." And there we have it, if we look at that passage carefully. One building is demolished and set on one side. It's a building of bricks and mortar. It is inadequate. And another is erected in its place. God's house to be built instead of David's temple. And what sort of a house is it? It's a house consisting of people, not made with hands, as the rest of the chapter goes on to show. And the building of it, well, that is the work of Messiah, the promised king of David's line. "I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. He shall build a house for my name, and I will be his father, and he shall be my son." So within the space of a few verses, we have all the ideas which are centered in the accusation leveled against Jesus of Nazareth. Destroying a temple, building another, made without hands by the power of God. The temple builder, Messiah himself, the promised king, who is also the Son of God. Every detail's there, brethren and sisters. And we must give these Jewish elders credit for knowing their scriptures as well, if not better, than we know them ourselves. If we can see patterns pointing forward to the work of Messiah in these ancient prophecies, you can be quite sure that they could as well. Can we not see then that Caiaphas' demand, "Tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God," follows on quite logically and directly from the accusation of the previous verses. He was determined to know whether this man was the temple builder and the founder member of that temple referred to in 2 Samuel chapter 7. Or rather, whether he claimed so to be. Caiaphas knew the pattern of that prophecy, and he said, "Now tell us whether you're claiming to be the one referred to." And so, because Jesus was put on oath, he answered. The law of his father required it of him. Let me read you a verse from Leviticus chapter 5 in the New International Version. It says there, "If a person sins because he does not speak up when he hears a public charge to testify regarding something he has seen or learned about, he will be held responsible." In other words, brethren and sisters, the witness put on oath must answer. And so Jesus did. We go back now to Matthew chapter 26. And we find that the answer Jesus gives was entirely in line with the things that we've just been considering. Matthew chapter 26, verse 64. What did he say? "Thou hast said." Tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. "Thou hast said." And that does not mean, "Well, that's what you're saying about me," as though he were half evading the answer. It was an uncompromising affirmative. The parallel records in the other Gospels show that quite clearly. He said, "Yes, I am." And then he continues, "And hereafter ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power." And that's Psalm 110. "The Lord said unto my Lord, Sit thou on my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool." It's also the psalm about being a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So here is Jesus not only claiming to be the foundation stone and the temple builder of 2 Samuel, but also king and priest as well. He goes even further, and coming in the clouds of heaven. And that's Daniel chapter 7, the Son of Man prophecy, about the one who was brought before the Ancient of Days in the clouds of heaven. A clear reference to the Shekinah glory of God. So Jesus is claiming for himself the endowment of the very spirit and power of his Father in the days to come. And of course that was exactly what Caiaphas wanted to hear. Verse 65, then the high priest rent his clothes, saying, he hath spoken blasphemy. What further need we of witnesses? Oh, they had need enough of witnesses a few moments earlier, brethren. But now suddenly everything seemed to be going their way, and Caiaphas was well satisfied. In triumph he rent his priestly garments in melodramatic fashion before them, indicating his condemnation of this blasphemy. I'm sure he didn't realize how significant that action was. Under the law, the high priest was forbidden to rend his garments for any cause. And so by rending his priestly robes, Caiaphas was in effect putting himself out of office. And from that time onward, this Jesus of Nazareth was to take his place as high priest over God's people. But in the heat of the moment, Caiaphas thought that he had triumphed. And so he addresses the council. Behold, now ye have heard his blasphemy. What think ye? And they said, he is guilty of death. And at this point in the trial, Luke records an additional detail which I think is worth noticing. If you'll just flip across to Luke chapter 22, verse 70. Luke chapter 22 and the 70th verse. Verse 69 establishes the context. As Jesus makes his claims, hereafter shall the Son of Man sit on the right hand of the power of God. Then notice this additional detail which Luke gives us. He said, then said they all, art thou the Son of God? And he said unto them, ye say that I am. And they said, what need we any further witness? For we ourselves have heard it from his own mouth. What an amazing spectacle that presents to us, brethren. You must use your imagination here. The Sanhedrin in a great semicircle. Jesus the prisoner with the high priest standing at the focus of attention at the front of the room. And following Caiaphas' interrogation, all these venerable elders of Israel on their feet shouting at Jesus, art thou then the Son of God? Yes, I am, comes back the answer. And Jesus is condemned. Back to Matthew chapter 26 for the concluding details. Matthew chapter 26, verse 66, to pick up the context. What think ye, says Caiaphas? They answered and said, he is guilty of death, meaning he is liable to the penalty of death. And then in the next verse we have details which seem almost incredible and yet which harmonize with the situation we saw developing at the end of Luke chapter 22. Matthew 26, verse 67, then did they spit in his face and buffeted him. Others smote him with the palms of their hands, saying, prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is he that smote thee? These elders of the people, these venerable doctors of the law, appear to have forgotten themselves completely in that moment. And it must have been the counselors who behaved in this fashion, for it goes on to say, and others smote him with the palms of their hands. So they spit in his face and buffeted him, and others, the temple guard, smote him with the palms of their hands. becomes abundantly clear, if you consult the parallel records in Mark and the other Gospels, it becomes abundantly clear that both the temple guard and the elders were involved in this rough house. Putting aside their dignity, brethren and sisters, they expressed their hatred and their scorn for Jesus of Nazareth by abusing him in this way. And you will recall the familiar prophecy, the words of the old prophet Isaiah. I gave my back to the smiters and my cheeks to them that plucked off the hair. I hid not my face from shame and spitting. And now the words were fulfilled. But more than that, they blindfolded him, they kicked him around, they punched him, saying, "Prophesy unto us, thou Christ, who is it that smote thee?" In all probability, brethren and sisters, one day he will tell them who smote him. He will see them face to face. And these were the things that our Lord was called upon to endure for us, that we might be spared. Right through the night, the whole experience must have been steadily wearing him down, and in the early hours of the morning, it had degenerated into such a situation as this. We go on to Matthew 27, verse 1, where we read of yet another meeting of the Sanhedrin. And when the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. So that's another meeting. It must have been a very brief affair in the hours of daylight. They were attempting to legalize their actions. They knew that the midnight trial was illegal, and so by the morning meeting they hoped to give the case a veneer of respectability. And so at first light of day, Jesus was formally condemned. They also took counsel how Jesus was to be put to death, for it was not competent for the Sanhedrin to pass capital sentence. They still had to get this decision out of the Roman governor. Some ancient Jewish authorities, for example in the Talmud, say that the power of life and death was taken from the Sanhedrin by the Roman authorities about 40 years before Jerusalem was destroyed. In other words, round about this very time, the power of life and death was taken from the Sanhedrin. And that being the case, it is just possible that this was the first capital offense to come before the council under the restricted code, in which event they would have been all the more keen to ensure that it was prosecuted to a successful conclusion, to maintain their place and their authority in the nation. And to help matters along, it seems that they had already approached the Roman governor, and that he was to some extent prepared for the deputation which met him early in the morning. But more of this tomorrow, God willing.